we're in Ecclesiastes 11 and 12 tonight, finishing this book of Ecclesiastes, which is very interesting to me. The perspective that man could have and really does have apart from God. Solomon here, a man who has lived his life in the very knowledge of God, but oftentimes his life was conducted in a worldly fashion. I don't know if you relate to that or not. Most of us can, from time to time, relate to the reality of knowing God, knowing His Word, knowing His ways, and yet sometimes our life is conducted in a worldly way. Solomon knew the truth and was compromised in his lifestyle, as you know. The many wives and concubines that Solomon had affected him, or we might even say infected him, with paganism and idolatry. And it caused him a great deal of sorrow in the end. It's a great way to start your life as a believer, but it's a better way to finish strong as a believer walking with the Lord. Solomon, unfortunately, didn't finish all that strong. Not saying he wasn't a believer and he wasn't saved. He just didn't finish that strong. And I'm sure that over the years you've perhaps viewed people in the same way. And perhaps you've even experienced some of that. My hope is that I'll finish strong. I want to finish well. I want to run the race, as Paul says, to win the prize. Meaning I want to be sprinting right at the end, you know, going full tilt for Jesus Christ, right up to the point that either he takes me home in the rapture or takes this body and lets it disintegrate into dust again and takes me home in the spirit, whichever. I want to finish strong. Solomon didn't, and he's an example for us. But much of what you read in this particular writing that Solomon penned, as we'll see, was God-breathed. All scripture is inspired, including this. So we look at it and we think, wow, that's a poor perspective, you know, that he has on this or that. And again, he is using man's point of view oftentimes. And then you'll see God's ways will creep in there and he'll allow that to kind of infiltrate the thinking, if you would. But keep in mind, we've broken this particular book into three sections. We started off with chapters 1 and 2, where Solomon basically proclaims the problem with man. And that is, life in and of itself is empty. It's vain. It doesn't mean a whole lot. It has no real purpose. In and of itself, man's existence is pretty, you know, stale. It doesn't really have a lot of meaning. You get into this world through birth, you know, which is painful, and then you live your life basically trying and striving to make ends meet, to make a living. You get up, you go to work, you go home, you go to bed, you get up, you go to work. I mean, you could do this thing over and over for your lifetime, and then, you know, you get old and you die, and that's life. You know, apart from a relationship with God, that's all there is to life. For many, that's all there is. That's it. And it's a pretty sad scenario in and of itself, isn't it? If that's all there is, then like Solomon says, then it's vanity of vanities. It's just emptiness. There's nothing much to it. So he proclaimed that in the first two chapters, just declaring that this is the way it is. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher as he starts off. And then in chapters 3 through 10, he's pondering the problem that life is empty. And we looked at that in the last couple of few weeks, how he's thinking these things through, that wow, you know, life is just full of all these dilemmas and problems, and you know, he goes through a number of scenarios in his thinking. And now in the last two chapters, it's what's happened to Solomon in the process of declaring this problem, you know, and now he's thought it through, and now he's persuaded in it. There's a persuasion that has affected Solomon. And we'll see here that he comes back, basically, comes full circle back around to God and says, you know, it all goes back to getting back to God and being in a relationship with God and respecting God and fearing Him. That's really all it boils down to, is he'll declare in the last part of the 12th chapter. But let's listen to him now as he kind of sums it up, if you would, this whole thing about life. And this is, again, the declaration here, what he's kind of persuaded with is that these things he's going to mention are the best things possible. for the man that's just the natural man on the earth, just a person living on the earth. No respect to God or anything else, just a man living. The best he can hope for is a good life, right? That things just don't go too terribly wrong for him, that he's fairly successful in what he does, and that his life is free from too much tragedy and trauma. That's the best a man can hope for, isn't it? Doesn't always work out that way, though, does it? Life doesn't always go by trial-free, does it? Or trauma-free, or tragedy-free. It's usually full of those things. And that's why, without God, there is really no hope for man. There's no hope. It's all emptiness. So let's hear what he says here. Verse 1 of chapter 11. He says, cast thy bread among the waters, for thou shalt find it after many days. The idea here is that sending your bread out into the water would be on ships, meaning your goods. Cast your bread out into the waters on ships, and generally what has to happen is after many days you will get your return. So if you send your goods out to market on ships, then in many days you'll see the return, because of course in those days everything went by ship, you know, across the waters, and then you got your return back. So he says do this, but that's going to require something of the one who sends the goods. That would be faith. You send your goods out into the waters on ships by faith, because who knows where they're going and when they're going to come back, or if they're going to come back, right? You put your goods on a ship, you're taking your chances, and it's going to require faith. Then he says, give a portion to seven and also to eight, for thou knowest not what evil shall be upon the earth. Meaning, be a good idea not to put all your bread on one ship. Put it on seven or eight. Divide it up. Spread it out, if you would. In other words, don't put all your eggs in one basket. This is just a good word, isn't it? It's just a wise word. For life, this is just a good way to look at things. Don't just sit there and put everything into this one thing. You see, spread it out. Because if one ship sinks, you've got seven others, or six others at least, that aren't going to sink. That's, you know, but if your ship sinks and everything's on it, you're sunk. That's the idea. So it's just some practical wisdom, you see. Not all in one ship or one basket, if you would. He says, if the clouds be full of rain, they empty themselves upon the earth. And if the tree fall toward the south or toward the north, in the place where the tree falleth, there it shall be. So if a tree falls, whichever direction it falls, once it falls, it's there. You know, tree doesn't move easy. Once it's down, it's down. And that's where it's going to lay, unless you got a chainsaw. Unless it's in the northwest, and then somebody's going to make firewood. But the point is that In the context of what he's saying here, it's interesting, because the clouds are moving all the time. Things change, don't they? And what he's getting at here is that if you only do things based upon a sure thing, then you'll probably never do anything. If you're waiting for the sure thing to come, and some people say that, don't they? Oh, I'm just waiting for the sure thing, right? Well, that person generally doesn't do anything, because the sure thing never shows up. If you're going to do anything that's worth doing, generally there's going to be some kind of risk involved. It's going to be some kind of chance you have to take, isn't there? That's just the way life is. If everything was a sure thing, then everybody would do those things, obviously. But there's not really any guidelines for sure things or vague things. The people who make successes of themselves, so to speak, they're the guys that take the risks, right? They take a chance. You know, somebody thought they might just make something up and produce it and make a product and market it. And hey, they took all the risk and all the chances. Then people get mad at them because they're rich, right? But they're the ones that took the chance and put themselves out there. Now, this is important. So the guy who does that, you know, is like the guy then, of course, that looks at the tree. Well, the tree falls and it's just there. There's a sure thing for you. Meaning the sure thing doesn't move much, and therefore nothing much happens. Tree just lays there. That's where how people's lives are oftentimes, aren't they? Nothing happens. Nothing ever takes place because they don't ever do anything. Now, he that observeth the wind shall not sow, and he that regardeth the clouds shall not reap. In other words, the guy that watches the wind blowing, oh, the wind's blowing, can't sow seed now, right? It's windy, right? Here's the guy that's kind of slothful in his thinking. And if there's clouds, he's not going to reap. In other words, it's never the right time for this guy to plant or reap or anything. He never does anything because the wind changes and because the rain comes and so forth. Well, that's what makes things grow. The idea is here, don't sit around. As thou knowest not what is the way of the Spirit, nor how the bones do grow in the womb of her that is with child, even so that knowest not the works of God who maketh all. So, in other words, we don't know how the wind moves. The Spirit here is referred to by Solomon. Of course, we know that is true. Jesus talked about it. The apostles talked about the wind, the Spirit. You don't know where it came from. You don't know where it's going, right? The wind is like the Spirit. We can't determine, can't control it. So he says, you don't know how the wind moves or the Spirit moves, just like you don't know how bones are formed in a child that's in the womb. That's always been a mystery, isn't it? It's like amazing. When you watch the time-elapsed growth process of an embryo, it's like, that just blows your mind, right? It's amazing. It's a miracle. Who can figure that one out? Not me. Well, man can't, and he doesn't know either how God works and makes all these things happen. We don't understand everything about God. And, by the way, that's supposed to be the way it is. Because we need faith. We have to exercise faith. And so we don't know everything. Therefore, you have to just take it on faith. God does all these things. How? I don't know. Well, how does he do that? Don't have a clue. Well, when's he going to do this? Don't know. Is this going to happen? Couldn't tell you. Right? Well, you're a lot of help. Exactly. So next time you think about coming to somebody for advice, you're probably not going to come to me. But that's probably a good thing. You need to go to the Lord because the Lord knows when he's going to do things. And if he sees fit to tell you, let me know, because he usually doesn't tell me. He usually just says what? Have faith. Just have faith. Faith is what's needed to please God. Without faith, it's impossible to please him. So we don't know all these things because we're supposed to exercise faith. That's a tough one for us. In the morning, verse 6, sow thy seed, and in the evening withhold not thine hand, for thou knowest not whether shall prosper either this or that, or whether they both shall be alike good. You don't know. Do your work. Sow the seed. Don't hold back. Work hard. Do what you know. Do what you know. There's a lot to be said in that one little sentence. Do what you know. A lot of people are waiting to know some more. But if they would do what they know, they'd be pretty busy, pretty occupied, right? And we all know enough. We really do. So do what you know is the idea here, because you don't know whether or not something's going to prosper or not. You don't know how God's going to bless you. He might bless something that you're doing just because you're working hard as unto him, right? So you just trust God. You have to trust, because you don't know what he's going to do with what you're doing, whether he's going to bless it or whether he's not. Truly, the light is sweet and a pleasant thing it is for the eyes to behold the sun. The sun is S-U-N, but I think it's more appropriate S-O-N, because it says, truly, the light is sweet. Jesus said, I am the light of the world, and he is sweet. He's the light, and he is sweet. And boy, it is really awesome for us to behold with our eyes the Son of God, isn't it? With the eyes of faith, we see him. We don't see him physically. People say, well, what does Jesus look like? I don't know what he looks like. I do know this. The Bible says he's altogether lovely, right? I know that he is the bright and morning star, right? I know that we are going to be in awe of him for eternity, you know. But I do know this as well. The Bible says that in his earthly form, he was not anything special. He wasn't anything to look at. He was just an average looking man. But as Christ, God the Son, we are going to be so blown away by him. I see him with the eyes of faith. I don't need to see him with my physical eyes yet. When I see him, I will be like him. That'll be a mind blower. Huh? When you see him, you're going to be like him. Wow. Be in him for eternity. That's going to be great. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be an amazing thing. So eyes of faith here, it's truly a blessing for us. It's a pleasant thing for the eyes to behold the sun, because the light is sweet. But if a man live many years and rejoice in them all, yet let him remember the days of darkness, for they shall be many. All that cometh is vanity. Now, he says, verse 9, rejoice, O young man, in thy youth. The key here, and he's going to talk about three things here. He's going to talk about rejoicing, the importance of it. The Bible affirms it. The Apostle Paul said, remember, rejoice. And again, I say rejoice, right? He emphasizes rejoicing is important. Rejoicing, that is being glad because you're alive and because God is on the throne. I can rejoice every day of my life because no matter what's happening, right? I'm in him and he's on the throne, therefore things are good. You know, how bad can it be? I can always rejoice in something. And he points out how important it is. Rejoice. Verse 8, he says, because there's plenty of dark days. There's many dark days. But rejoicing is the answer to the dark day. Rejoicing, guys, is the answer to dark days. When dark days come, start rejoicing in what God has done. Well, it's a dark day, though. Why should I rejoice in that? This is the way that the Lord has made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Well, even the dark ones, especially the dark ones, especially days that are traumatic, difficult, hardship days. It's most important to rejoice in the days that are difficult. And sometimes there's many of them. Rejoice, O young man, he says, in thy youth. That's a good word for some younger folks. Rejoice because you're young, because you won't always be. It's a little more difficult to rejoice in your youth when you're not youthful anymore, I've discovered. You know, I was at church Sunday at Riverview after church. Everybody's hanging around. It's kind of a nice day. And we just finished the kind of the basketball court there, and guys were playing basketball. And I was watching my son Daniel, and they're out there playing. And, you know, he shot the ball and got the rebound and jumped way up in the air and threw it in the basket. And I'm like, wow, he's young, right? I mean, he's like springing around like a little gazelle or something. I'm like, wow, I couldn't do that when I was young, frankly. But I thought, rejoice in your youth, because you're not going to be doing that the rest of your life, let me tell you. You might as well enjoy that while you can do it, because you're going to pay for that later. When I tried doing those things when I was young, oh boy, I'm still paying for those things. My body's going, oh, you dummy, what were you thinking? So he says, rejoice in your youth and let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart and in the sight of thine eyes. But know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. Meaning, enjoy your youth. Walk after the things that your heart knows to be true. Meaning, don't abuse your youth. I, for one, did that. I abused my youth. And now I'm paying for it. A lot of regret, a lot of sorrow in the older years when you abuse the younger ones, isn't there? So he says, understand that God will deal with abuse of pleasure. Pleasure is a good thing as long as it's not abused. The problem with the world is that all they are interested in is pleasure, too much of it. And that'll ruin a person. It becomes sinful. There's nothing wrong with sex in the marriage relationship. Outside of that, it's abuse, destructive. There's nothing wrong with the things that we like to enjoy. As long as we don't go overboard with them, it becomes sinful at some point. And God says he'll deal with us on those. Now, so rejoice is the first thing. Then he says in verse 10, therefore, remove sorrow from thy heart. So rejoice, first of all, and now he says remove. Remove what? Remove sorrow, or literally, remove anxiety. Rejoicing is the first step to removing anxiety. Someone who's full of anxiety just isn't rejoicing very much. No, rejoicing increases the intensity of anxiety. When you don't rejoice, you get a lot of anxiety going. So he says remove the sorrow or anxiety from your heart. And again, the first step would be start back up in the verse before it. Rejoice. First, rejoice. And then he says, put away evil from thy flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity. When your childhood and youth are filled with the flesh and the evils of the flesh, then it becomes a very empty thing. Again, I know that reality. My youth was empty. My younger years were full of evil, fleshly vanity. And all it was about me. It's all about me. What I want to do, what I want to, you know, think, how I want to act. Everything was about me. And it was totally emptiness. I look back and go, man, I agree with you, Solomon. Vanity of vanities. That's how it was for me. So he says, now remove this by remembering that your youth and the things that you do are going to come back. They're going to cost you something at some point. Now, interesting, because in verse 10, what's really being said is this. The best way to have a blessed older life in your older years is to live a blessed younger life. That's the deal. How many times, how many of us, I know I'm forgiven for all my sin, but there are things that I carry and always will until the day I leave this body. There are things that I carry that I've done in my youth. And as much as I know I'm forgiven, and I know I am, those things are still scarring my character. You know what I'm saying? And they will always be there. So I'm blessed, certainly, in my older years because God is gracious and merciful and good. But I know this as well. My blessed older years could be even more blessed. So when I tell young people, don't blow it like I did. Don't do what I did. Live a blessed younger life. You'll have even a more blessed older life in your older years. It was Charles Spurgeon that said, youthful sins lay a foundation for aged sorrows. True. Your youthful sins will lay a foundation for your aged sorrows when you're older. So then he says, rejoice and then remove sorrows or anxiety. And then verse 1 of chapter 12, remember now thy creator. Remember God. So rejoicing, right? Removing anxiety all stems from remembering God. Remember God, rejoice in him, remove anxiety. All of those work together. Remove God from the equation and there's no rejoicing or removal of anxiety, is there? It all works together, and this is important. So he says, remember now thy creator in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. Meaning, I'm going to remember God, and I'm going to seek to obey what God declares. This is the secret, this is the key to experiencing what God says I can have. People say, well, how come I don't have what God says I can have? He promises in his word this, and he promises that. And you know, you boil down the whole equation, and you come up with this. They don't obey what he says. People don't obey what God says, and therefore they don't enjoy, don't experience what he says they can have if they would obey him. The idea of a lack of participation on my part, that God's just going to overlook that and just bless me with all kinds of spiritual blessings and all the blessings of life because he just wants to bless me anyway. Well, that's not what God says. Well, we are given grace and mercy that we don't deserve, that's for sure. But if you want to experience the things God says you can have ultimately, you're going to have to participate in that one through obedience, through practical living your life for Christ. So he says, verse 2, while the sun or the light or the moon or the stars be not darkened, nor the clouds return after the rain. In other words, there comes a point where you can't see as good as you used to about things. You don't have the same kind of enjoyment that you used to have oftentimes when that's true. You've probably experienced this. You've kind of drifted from God. You're not really obeying his word. You know he loves you, but you really aren't experiencing much of the spiritual wealth that he'd like for you to have. And you find that life in general isn't nearly as enjoyable as it once was when you were really close to him, when you were really intimate with him. And this isn't God saying, I'm going to get you for that. You drifted off, so here, you know, be miserable. He's not doing that. That's what happens to us. People blame God for it sometimes. Well, God's mad at me. That's why I'm not enjoying life anymore. No, no, no. You're not enjoying life anymore because you've drifted away from the Lord. You're in a state of disobedience to God, and therefore life takes its course the way God says it will, and it results in a lack of enjoying life. You can't enjoy it. You're miserable. So you can't enjoy it because you're not in that relationship. And now he's going to bring on a subject matter towards the end of this thing that's really vivid. And he's going to talk about now the guy who is approaching the end. This is describing old age. And it's very descriptive. It's one of the most descriptive versions I've ever read, actually. Watch what he says. So in the day when the keepers of the house shall tremble, you're the house, okay? This is the idea. You're the house. And when the keepers of the house shall tremble, and the strong men shall bow themselves, meaning your limbs aren't what they used to be. Your legs, your arms. You ever notice this? Some of you that are getting a little older. I don't want to get personal, but things start sagging, you know, hanging a little bit. You know, it's like, what's that? You know, I didn't have that before, right? And it just doesn't seem to ever go away. You know? I mean, it's like, it's just starting to fall apart. He says, and the grinders cease because of the fewness of them, or they are few. That's your teeth. Your grinders are your teeth. And he says, the grinders are ceasing because there's few of them. In other words, your teeth are falling out. And those that look out of the windows be darkened. That's your vision. Your eyes are going. Your teeth are falling out, right? Your house is starting to shake a bit and tremble. And he says, and the doors shall be shut in the streets when the sound of the grinding is low. Well, there goes your hearing. Your hearing's going now. And he shall rise up at the voice of the bird. There goes your sleep, right? You ever talk to old people? They wake up early oftentimes. They can't sleep. They want to, but as soon as the birds chirp, they're up. And that's the end of it. I don't have that problem yet. But I know people that do. They can't sleep. So this is descriptive. I mean, the person can't sleep. He's up with the birds. And all the daughters of music shall be brought low. Meaning, the singing voice is shot now. The poor old guy can't carry a tune in a bucket anymore. And when they shall be afraid of that which is high. Meaning, high places like standing up, all right. They're afraid of high places, meaning they're afraid when they come downstairs. It's true, isn't it? It's just a great, vivid description. And fear shall be in the way, meaning when they walk just in the way, when they're walking down the street or walking places, they are fearful somewhat that they would fall. When older people fall, it can be very troublesome. They can break a hip. They can get hurt. They can be, you know, putting themselves in a pretty distressing way. And the almond tree shall flourish. Now, the almond tree, when it buds out its flowers, it's kind of a pinkish color, but from a distance, it looks white or gray. So this is talking about your hair, if you have any. That the hair now is white, you know. And the grasshopper shall be a burden. This is the description of a grasshopper that drags himself along the ground at the end of his season. What grasshoppers do is they're not real bouncy anymore. You know how grasshoppers bounce? The grasshoppers at the end of his life just kind of drags himself. He just kind of drags himself along, and that's what this is saying. The grasshopper shall be a burden, or he just drags himself across the ground, you know. It's just a wow. It's just a description that's really vivid. So, and the desire shall fail. Well, that can mean a couple of things. It can mean certainly a loss of appetite in all kinds of ways, is the point. We'll just leave it at that. And it says, because man goes to his long home, that is his eternal home, and the mourners go about the streets. There's a point where he's going to go home. And it's the long home, meaning this is not home. This is not the long haul here. This is the short stay. The long home is what's coming next, the eternal home. So he goes to that place and the mourners will start to mourn. Or he says, ever the silver cord be loosed. This could be describing, probably is, a lamp that's hung by a silver cord. And it says, the golden bowl be broken. Meaning the silver cord hangs there with the golden lamp, and the cord breaks, and then the lamp crashes down, and the light goes out. Probably referring to a rich man. A man that has money would have a silver cord with a golden lamp. Could be Solomon himself that he's referring to. But what he's saying here is death is no respecter of persons. You can't buy your way out of it. Doesn't matter how many gold lamps you have or how many, you know, money market accounts you have. It doesn't make any difference. Death doesn't wait. You know, it's not going to be bribed. You can't say, well, look, I'll give you $10 million. Just don't take me. Yeah, he won't listen. death will come. Or he says, if a pitcher be broken at the fountain or a wheel broken at the cistern. Now, same idea. You lower a bucket down into the well. The cord breaks. The water spills out. In Israel's history, vividly, water spoke of life, the water of life, living water. We refer to in the New Testament, Jesus is the living water. Water, speaking of life, when the water spills out of the bucket, so to speak, life's over. When the light goes out in the lamp, we're done. That's the idea. But then he says, then shall the dust return to the earth as it was, and the spirit shall return unto God who gave it. Every spirit of a man will have to face God. Every spirit of a man returns to God. Whether they stay with God or not depends on whether they know him here or not. But every spirit goes to meet God at some point. So this is all true. When the life goes, the dust of our bodies returns to dust. Then he says in verse 8 again, this term he's used throughout the study, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, all is vanity. Just all emptiness in and of itself. There's nothing to life other than empty, painful, you know, purposeless living. It just doesn't make any sense apart from God. Now watch what he says finally here. And moreover, because the preacher was wise, that's him, he still taught the people knowledge. Solomon was a wise man, perhaps the wisest man that ever lived. He was given that wisdom from God. And he says the preacher, that is him, was wise. He was given that wisdom from God, and he taught the people knowledge. Yea, he gave good heed and sought out and set in order many proverbs. He wrote many of the proverbs. He wrote the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon did. He wrote the Song of Solomon, Song of Songs. He put many things in order, meaning he wrote down the things that he was shown and given by God, that wisdom that was given to him. But watch. He says, the preacher sought to find out acceptable words or pleasant words, and that which was written was upright, even words of truth. So what he's saying is, this is truth I'm writing. The perspective, in many regards, is man's perspective, but it's an important perspective to have. You have to know it in order to realize what an empty perspective it is. When we go through this, didn't you find yourself looking at the things he says were empty and vain? Didn't you look at those things again with perhaps a new sense of how very empty life is without God? It's important for us to do that. And that's why he really was arranging these things the way he was. And he sought to put in order many of these things with acceptable words and words of truth. He says, verse 11, the words of the wise are as goads and as nails fastened by the masters of assemblies, which are given from one shepherd. Now, this is where every single commentator agree that Solomon is declaring that this book of Ecclesiastes was God-breathed. It came from the one shepherd, came from God. And I want you to note the way that he describes the words of wisdom in verse 11. Goads here, that word goads is something that you prod somebody with. You know, you poke them. So the words of wisdom, the word that God speaks, that God breathes, will always do a little poking to the listener, to the hearer, won't it? It always pokes a little bit. So there's goads, but he says there's also nails fastened by the master. So nails are things you can hang things on. So part of the word pokes me, but much of the word is something I can hang on. I can put things on it and hang it there. It's going to be secure. In other words, I can hold on to it. I can hang on to it. The word does both of those things, you know, and it should. You know, sometimes when we hear something in the word, we go, boy, that nails it, right? I mean, that nails it for me. Well, that's the idea. The nails, even though it might prod you or poke you, kind of like a goad would, it's still the truth. And even though it kind of pokes, it's like, yeah, that's true. Ouch. You know, but it's so true that you have to hang that truth up in the mind's eye, if you would, of your thinking. So he says, it's given by one shepherd, the good shepherd, God breathed. And then he says in verse 12, and further, by these, my son, be admonished. Of making many books, there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. What he means by that is this. There's a lot of books out there. You know this. It troubles me a bit when people read more Christian books than they do the Bible. Christian books, they don't have anything against them. We have a Christian bookstore, as you know, inside Cafe 101. Most of the books in there, though, are pretty much geared for your study of God's Word. That's what I'm really encouraging people to do, is to study God's Word. And we may have books that will help you do that. There's nothing wrong with some of the devotional books and some of the books that are written by some of the people that are testimonies and so forth. Nothing wrong with that. But don't neglect this in light of those things that are out there. There's many books. In fact, he says there's no end to them. There's just plenty of books out there. Much study, though, is weariness sometimes of the flesh. You can study so much, and yet it may just be wearying your flesh, because you don't want to let man's books, so to speak, rob you of God's wisdom and blessings. This is God's wisdom. And perspective is great. And some people I read, I think, wow, that was great perspective. But I'm always going to come back to this, the Bible, in order to find my wisdom in its raw and purest form. And I still, to this day, have found no better commentary on the Bible than the Bible. This is the pure Word of God, and it's still the best, isn't it? So, again, in light of what he says, watch this now. Let us then, verse 13, hear the conclusion of the whole matter. So he says, let's wrap up with this. This is the conclusion of the whole thing, the whole discussion we've had. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Respect God, do what he says. There's plenty to do in just that one thing, that one sentence. Fear God and do what he says. That's going to keep you busy for the rest of your life. Right? People say, what else am I supposed to do? Do that. Do that, and that'll do it. You don't have to think about anything else. Believe me, if you're doing this, you won't have to ask, what else do I need to do? This will keep you occupied day in, day out for the rest of your life. So he says, for God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. What Solomon declares is very true, very important. Everything, he says, every work, every conduct that's performed, but also every secret thing, meaning every thought, every single thought, God knows. He knows what they are. See, when people try to divert from what their responsibility to believe in God and submit to him, oftentimes they'll say, well, I do a pretty good job living my life. I mean, I'm not a bad guy. I'm not a bad person. You know, I don't rip people off. You know, I don't hurt people. I try and live my life decently. You know, and they're sincere when they say that. I mean, they are absolutely sincere, saying, I'm just trying to live a decent life. You know, I have a lot of respect for people, and I don't take advantage of people and all the rest, and they're very sincere about it. The problem is, they don't take into account this reality. God looks at the secret things. He looks in the thoughts. He knows. He's the discerner of the heart. So he looks inside, and he knows the inner parts, the inner workings, if you would, of our minds and the things that are in our hearts, even the things we don't know about. Like Jeremiah says, the heart is wicked and deceitful above all things. Who can know it? He says, who can even know your own heart? But God does. God knows your heart. So the thoughts, David said in Psalm 51, Lord, you are concerned about the truth in the inner parts. You know what's going on in here and in here. You know the inner workings of me. That's what will also be brought up in judgment. So when someone says, oh, I live a pretty good life, well, that's not going to work real well when it comes down to the judgment, because God's going to go right to your mind, right down to the depths of your soul and your heart. So now it's interesting. I'm done in here in just a second, but it's interesting. Six times in this discussion, Solomon encourages the reader to enjoy his life. He says, enjoy your life while you can. If you're young, be thankful you're young. Rejoice in that. Enjoy your life. So he has encouraged us to enjoy our life, but he never encourages us to enjoy our sin, even though he is bringing to us man's perspective in many respects. Solomon never in this whole book says, hey, why don't you just enjoy your sin? Why doesn't he say that? Even though the worldly perspective oftentimes is what he's bringing to the table, he never brings that up. Do you know why? Even the world knows better than that. The world knows better than trying to say, well, I know that sin is absolutely against God and against what I know to be true, but I'm going to enjoy it anyway. Well, the world knows that that perspective is not only unrealistic, but it sounds terrible. And frankly, most of the world, even though they're living amiss, will try and convince you that they're somewhat noble in the way they try and live, right? Like the guy I just described to you a minute ago. I'm a decent sort of person, right? Even that person, the worldly person, knows to enjoy sin would be a bold-faced lie in the reality that they know to be true, and that is they can't. They can't enjoy it. Warren Wiersbe said, the joys of the present depend on the security of the future. It's true. How can you enjoy the present right now? How could you possibly enjoy life if you did not know where your future lied? You can't. You couldn't. Why is the world so fouled up and lost and hurting and sick? And why? Because they have an uncertain future. They have no security in where they will be after this. And that is very disconcerting. Most people don't want to think about it. They don't want to spend any time soul searching to really think that through and let their conscience really be revealed that they really have no way of coming to terms or getting a grip on that. That's way out there. It's like, no, that's never going to happen, although it happens to everybody. So I think it's true. I think what Wiersbe said is absolutely accurate and right on. Enjoyment of this present time depends on the security of my future. Again, that's why I began this study by saying, you know, you're going to heaven if you're saved, right? I mean, God's on the throne now, and all things are working together for the good for those that love God and are called according to his purpose. As Romans 8:1 says, there is no condemnation for us. We're in Christ. So my present is enjoyable because my future is heaven. But life here and now could be nothing but hellish if my future is hell. And that describes much of what mankind lives like. So Solomon here, you might think he's a pessimist, but he's really not. What he says is the whole deal is vanity of vanity. It's empty unless you fear God and you know where you're going. And then there's purpose because, again, all things then are working together for good. For who? For those that love God and are called according to his what? Purpose. All of a sudden life has purpose. But without that, without the calling on my life, and without the relationship, the love relationship between me and God, then life really doesn't have any purpose other than a sad scenario that's lived out and then eternally is damned. That's why he says this whole thing, apart from God, vanity, empty, nothing. It's a shame. That's what it is, apart from God. So, aren't you glad you know God? Because, man, you know, where would we be? Wouldn't want to think about that. Wouldn't want to even ponder that one too long. I know, you know, because I know where I was. And if I was continuing down that path, I know where I would probably be today, you see. So let's go to the table just for a few minutes tonight and take communion. It's that wonderful thing we get to do in remembering what Jesus Christ has done for us. It's the one thing I find so amazing about our Lord is that when he asked us to do something for him, he could have asked us to do anything, and we would have done it. I mean, wow, you've given your life for us. You've saved us. You forgave our sin. So what do you want, Lord? And all he said was, do this in remembrance of me. Remember what I've done for you. That's all. Because if we don't remember it regularly, and he said, do it as often as you eat or drink. You know, I know for me, that's a pretty regular thing. But he said, remember it often, because if you don't, you will certainly start to think that you're doing it on your own. You'll certainly start getting your motor running and okay, I'm gonna keep up now, Lord. I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna do that. And Jesus said, No. The work is finished. I want you to rest in me. Come to the table and let's have some supper. Let's have some fellowship. Let's talk. Your sin's forgiven. So it's fellowship he's longing for now. Just coming to him, talking to him, spending a few moments at his table saying, Lord, I remember what you've done. It was huge. It's the life saver for me. It's the life changing work for me. And I thank you for it and I remember you for it. That's it. And he does amazing things in that moment. The Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 11 says that there's many that are sick and weak and even dying spiritually inside. They're drying up. They're withering away because they do not discern the Lord's body or give it value, give the communion table any value or worth. They just ignore it or make it some kind of ritual where they just, okay, let's all take communion. Well, that's not what he had in mind. And Paul says when you do that, you're drinking unworthily, if you would, because you're not giving him worth. There's no value in it. So when we come to the table, remember him. Remember Jesus Christ, what he did for you. That's all he wants. Spend a few minutes with him. Tell him you love him. You know, ask him for guidance if that's what you're looking for. Ask him for cleansing if that's what you need, which is probably what you need. But he's so faithful. All he wants is to be with you and to be close to you. And so that's what we do in this time. So you come when you're ready and meet with him, because he's here tonight. He's here to meet with you. He's ready to meet with us.